This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Enterprise Biz Bytes. My name is Rich Bradbury. I'm joined in the studio by
Frida Liu
and Christine Wong.
It is Monday, the 26th of February, 2018. And boy, have we got some stories for you. We're going to be starting off with this is probably my favorite story so far of the day. In an era of smart things, sometimes dumb stuff is better.
Mm-hmm.
Then, thanks, robots, right? There's a whole bunch of jobs that we non-tech job skills are in demand.
Okay.
Frida's story, 5 ways to prevent decision fatigue from ruining your productivity.
Actually, it's more to...
We changed it to five steps.
We
did this last week as well.
Yeah, five steps to harness your brain's unconscious decision-making.
There we go.
That's a great article.
And then we had the CD business isn't dying, it's just evolving. Right, so let's start off with this first story. And this kind of made me giggle this morning when I read it. Alexa, do either of you have one of these Alexa devices?
Nine.
No.
Okay, so these are obviously one of these smart devices that can light up your living room where you go, Alexa, just turn on the lights. And of course, it will do that. And everything, as we know, is connected to the internet. You know, tech companies are adding internet connections to just about everything you can imagine so that they can be controlled with smart speakers or phones. So it's thermostats and surveillance cameras, mosquito zappers, coffee makers, you name it, it's got a Wi-Fi connection. Now, they're becoming really popular. And in 2017, 15% of American households owned a home automation device, up from 10% in April 2016. So, but before we get carried away setting up the Wi-Fi connections on all of our appliances, lights, and fashion accessories, let's just look at some of the most mundane devices, because they're designed to accomplish a single task extremely well.
Okay.
And in some cases, they will still execute those duties better than their high-tech brethren. Let's have a couple of examples.
Before you get to examples, though, do you find that a lot of households have these things yet here in Malaysia?
I have a few friends that do have a bunch of these devices, the Google stuff, so Google turn my lights on, Alexa, turn my lights on. But one of the things that I came across, a normal wristwatch versus the Apple Watch, right? So when the Apple Watch first came out, I thought it was really cool. I thought it was a nice invention. And then I saw that one of the most important things that a watch should do wasn't available. You know, it doesn't tell the time for a whole 24 hours because the battery does indeed die. So by all measures, you know, and all sales measures, it's a hit. You know, it's fast, it's water resistant, versatile with a long battery life. But one of the problems it does have is that to see the time, you have to tilt your wrist to be able to look at the time, right? I mean, you do that on a normal phone, a normal watch anyway.
Yeah.
But imagine if you're riding a bicycle and you want to see the time. How do you twist your wrist?
Right.
To check? Just a little thing like that, a little nagging little issue that would get to me. So the next one, the car mount versus the smart car console. So a lot of cars nowadays are coming with this little console built in that have all of these little gadgetry built in, you know, GPS in there and one thing or another. What if you like using Waze over what's built into these cars? You can't use it, right? You have to. So why not just plug in one of these little
the
mount?
Yeah,
you can use Waze. You can use whatever. Especially if you're using something that has Apple Play in it, you have to use the Apple Maps. You can't use Google Maps. You can't use Waze. Anyway, that's my little gripe about that one. Alarm clock versus the Amazon Echo Spot. So Echo Spot is something that's doing quite well in sales. It's a smart alarm clock with a touchscreen Alexa virtual assistant. But one of the features it does have, it has a built-in camera for placing video calls. I don't know about you, but I'm not entirely sure that I would like a digital clock at the side of my bed that has a built-in camera.
I forget right?
And also you know, I'm assuming that as a smart device, the price tag is slightly higher.
Correct.
And the whole point of an alarm clock is to slap it violently on the snooze button.
Throw it around a little
bit. Flies across the room, you
know?
So I really feel like that's doing far too much for something that is supposed to serve one purpose.
Correct. You know, and it's just one of those things that is crying out for hackers to get inside of it and start fiddling around.
Like spying on you through the camera, and it's right next to your bed.
Correct. Amazon have said, you know, you can turn off the software, but, you know, whatever.
But can you?
The other one, a kitchen timer versus Amazon Echo. Great idea, right? A kitchen timer is one of those beautiful things that you just turn it and it dings when the time's run out. The Amazon thing, though, you know, you just say to it, okay, time me 8 minutes or time me 7 minutes, and it will do. It will count down for you. But how do you know how much time is left? I mean, if you look at your normal timer, you can see it ticking down.
Right.
The Amazon thing, though, you have to open up your smartphone and then look at the timer. So if you're cooking in the kitchen and you're covered in flour or whatever, you're getting all of this all over your device. What a waste. Finally, a piece of paper versus a tablet. How simple is that?
Yes.
So, you know, when you buy a new iPad or whatever, you know, the tablet often gets relegated to the kitchen, right? It becomes like a menu reader or a recipe reader. Again, it's just going to end up with filth all over
it. You know, I have bought, I think, two tablets which I have not used.
At all?
No, it's hardly... So, in my handbag, there's always a notebook.
Uh-huh, yes.
So, the physical...
I prefer it too. Yeah.
Right? And it's there. I can flick, flick, flick. And,
constantly, right? If you have a little idea, you just quickly jot it down on your pen. You just pop it in your bag.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, you get out your pen and you're like, damn it, the battery's dead.
Where did I store it? Yeah, whatever.
The battery's dead. If I drop it, I'm lost it.
I mean, even on the concept of the watch as well, like I have a smartwatch, but it keeps running out of battery. And then I'm like, well, now I have to charge my watch. What kind of problem is this where I need to charge my watch to know the time?
It's ridiculous. Let us know. Smart devices versus dumb devices. Which side of the fence do you sit on? Get us on WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or on Twitter, of course, at BFM Radio. So a short break when we come back. Thanks, robots. Now these four non-tech job skills are in demand. We'll be back in just a second here on Enterprise Biz Bytes on BFM 89.9.
Barcelona, Fiorentina, Manchester United, BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bytes. Now, if you are a regular listener, you've probably heard us talking about the future of AI and machine learning and all of this kind of stuff. A bunch of us discussing whether or not AI and robots are going to be taking jobs away from us in the future. Where do we stand as a species if this were to eventually happen? Christine, you've got a few details about some skills in particular that we have that are unique, right?
Yeah, so the idea is that robots can't do everything. As terrifying as artificial intelligence is, there are some things that humans can do that robots just can't. And hopefully more and more companies realize that they'll need the best of both worlds to unleash the full potential of both humans and machines.
God, that sounds like a great ad.
Yes, so these are the four non-tech job skills. So the first one is contextualization. So you can have AI and you can have machine learning, but it's only useful for solving straightforward, predictable problems. It's finding patterns, it's using data and making calculations, but they're less helpful when it comes to issues where it's not a given what the problem actually consists of. So the example given here is a patient gradually stops taking her medication and an algorithm picks up on that fall off early on, but the algorithm won't know why this patient is taking her medication. So you need a human being to ask why and to contextualize the reasons with a full understanding of what it means to live with a chronic illness. For example, is the patient simply forgetting to take her medication? Are they actively choosing not to take the medication? Or is there an alternative that they found that suits them better?
Mm-hmm.
So the AI can't do that by itself. The second thing is...
But they just serve as a good warning.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the second thing is curiosity. So basically with robots and AI and machine learning, it can only think about what you have told it is possible, whereas humans can think and transcend past the parameters set for ourselves.
Why?
Yes.
Yeah, right?
Yes. Why? But also, like, what more is there, right? So, you know, robots can't quite envision how, for example, a painting might create ideas for a city planner, or how a poem can aid a foreign CEO in understanding something about a market that they don't know about. So it's the idea that robots cannot be programmed to think creatively about what's possible if the possibility doesn't seem likely in the first place. So basically, robots can't write Harry Potter is really what that boils down to. Number three is critical thinking. So over recent years, we've seen societies become more polarized. As a result, healthy skepticism has become a crucial skill. So as AI continues to evolve, we need people who are able to question what algorithms appear to tell us. Because what algorithms do is, you know, they'll take data, they'll calculate it, they'll give us results, but it cannot actually understand, you know, what those algorithms might be saying. For example, if crime is up in a certain area where a certain population lives, the algorithm can tell us that data, but it won't tell us what that actually means. So that's another thing. So the fourth one is an ethical judgment. The average algorithm cannot distinguish good from bad. It just performs functions it's programmed to perform. So established industries have learned to incorporate ethical concerns into their business models and profit from them. For example, with airbags in the car industry, you know, that would be nice. And things like now thinking about environmental issues where companies are now trying to go green and trying to protect the earth. Algorithms just can't do that. YouTube, for example, has seen disastrous consequences that has arisen when they've relied on algorithms alone. For example, with the videos that were meant to be for children but actually had very violent adult content. But the algorithm thought it was fine. And so all these children were exposed to all the content that should not have been, you know, that should have been age restricted. And they're now trying to find out of a new way of using teams of human moderators alongside algorithms to help determine what content is actually fit.
Right. You know, the other thing that I heard, like in terms of skills that will be still required, people like coaches and counselors, you know,
teachers.
And teachers, because that sort of thing, you still need that human interaction, because especially with technology, you're going to be a lot more disconnected. Right. And you probably, you know, we're just going to be working in technology and not having this human contact. And so these kind of careers where there's still a lot of understanding and all that, these kind of careers will continue to be on. Maybe not the person at McDonald's or a fast food chain, right, where there's not much thought required. Mm. That sort of thing will definitely disappear.
Relates back to the other story, though. In an era of smart things, sometimes dumb is better.
Yeah.
No, but having, I think, having humans as, this sounds ridiculous, I can't believe we're having this conversation. Having humans as like that buffer, you know, to kind of sit there and say, I'm sorry, Mr. Robot, but that decision that you've just made is incorrect. The algorithm is great. However, this person has done this because this, this, and this. And, but then how do you feed that data back into those algorithms for it to adjust, you know, to kind of future-proof it?
And that's why you, like, even you hear in hotels or where there's customer service and someone complains and then they'll say, oh, but we can't do this because we can't do this or this or this because of the process, right? So people can follow the process, but if there's no human, and that's where the complaints come in.
Right.
Because you're not listening to me, right?
Yeah.
And it's not like, I can't do this because it's like this. Right, that just will annoy
for sure
the customer a lot more.
I think it's a matter of, you know, making sure that algorithms are not just doing the whole process independently, and making sure that, you know, there is that element where, you know, before it makes a decision, just to stop and be like, okay, let's pause and maybe reconfigure, because you don't need to change how the algorithm thinks. You just need to have that extra level of kind of security and like a double check, basically, from someone who is able to contextualize, to be curious, to critical think, and to have ethics also to make the final decision to push the button themselves.
Interesting. Right, time for a short break. We've got some ads coming up and some music from the Yeah Yeah Yeahs with Sacrilege. When we get back, 5 steps to harness your brain's unconscious decision-making powers. That sounds like a lot of sleeping things.
Yeah, I know.
All right. Don't go anywhere. BFM 89.9.
Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise BizBytes. I'm Rich Bradbury in the studio with
Frida Liu
and Christine Wong.
Again, if you want to get in touch via Twitter, we're at BFM Radio, or of course on WhatsApp 018-789-8899. We've had a couple of stories so far. We started off with an era of smart things. Sometimes dumb stuff is better. Then we had a story about, thanks robots, a few non-tech job skills are in demand, including contextualization, curiosity, critical thinking, and the other one was ethics, was it?
Yes.
All right.
Critical judgment.
Ethical judgment. Right. So we've had 4 things there. Now 5 things here.
Ah, I love this story. So this came out from Fast Company. It's 5 steps to harness your brain's unconscious decision-making powers. Yes, sleeping on it actually works.
Right.
Right. Yay. You know, and that's why I sleep a lot. The science behind this, right? So if sleeping on it works, partly because when you sleep, your prefrontal cortex, the center of what makes you you, powers down. That means your personality, your decisions, your social controls go to sleep with you. The night is when your unconscious really does have free rein, right? It can do its work without interference. And here's how the process works and what you can do to leverage it when you've got tough decisions waiting on you in the morning. And this gave a very good example as well. So actually, while our conscious mind rests, our unconscious is busy making sense of the day's events and filing them away in long-term memory. And if there are any problems in your mind, your unconscious will work on these right? And it's true, as Graham Bell pointed out, that a problem can seem insurmountable when you go to bed, but when you wake up, it doesn't seem so daunting. And here's the thing. If your unconscious is aware that your conscious mind has been working hard on a problem, come nighttime, it'll put its full processing power behind it. But the outcome of that process depends on a couple of things. First, your conscious mind needs to have been working hard on a problem. And second, you need to passionately require an answer in order to get your unconscious to work on you. He says it's like the classic children's fairy tale, The Elves and the Shoemaker, where the penniless shoemaker lays out his last piece of cloth and the elves come in the night and turn it into a beautiful pair of shoes.
Right.
Now, so it also helps if you can remember your dreams and you can see the unconscious at work already. And so our dreams, even though we have no control of them, are very good at solving our problems. This is because when we're dreaming, our minds are in the REM state, which has been found to be highly conducive to fluid reasoning and flexible thought. So this was a study done in 2002, and researchers tested participants' ability to solve amygdala puzzles when they're woken from a deep REM sleep, compared with when they were roused from a normal, lighter dose. And those woken up from REM sleep proved 32% better at solving these anagrams.
Really?
Mm.
I would be like grumpy as heck. You know, you wake me up. You want to solve an anagram? What?
Yeah, it always takes me about like 10 minutes in the morning just to restart, I guess.
Right,
you know,
right.
It's as if like my brain is installing updates like a Windows computer, kind of thing.
So here are the five steps, right? So there is a way for your unconscious work for you. How do you make it work for you? So set it a challenge. Say, for instance, you're unhappy in your job, not anyone in this room, and don't know whether to leave or not. Now, when you think about it in the daytime, your conscious mind is beset with different opinions and emotions on the subject. It's like sitting around a table with 20 friends debating the subject, and they all generally want to help, but their different opinions just make it a little bit overwhelming. So if you set the problem for your unconscious to work on, this is what you do. Before you go to bed, spend 30 minutes thinking in a relaxed way about the problem or issue. So 30 minutes. Should I stay?
Gotcha. Yeah.
You know, some mild, you know, some light music in the background. Then when you get into bed, actually write down the problem and ask the question out loud to yourself. Also give it a deadline. So too much pressure creates stress. You don't want to be lying awake thinking about the problem. That will just send it round and round in your conscious mind and won't be helpful at all. We've been there.
Mm-hmm.
But a little bit of gentle pressure can help. So set a time when you want to nail down an answer. You might say out loud and write down, I'm unhappy in my job and want to know what I should do. I would like an answer by 7 in the morning when I wake up.
It's like using your brain as a magic 8 ball.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Magic.
I'm going to go back home and write down all my problems.
I will like an answer by 7 in the morning.
Yeah.
So when you wake up, write down any immediate thoughts or insightful dreams you can remember, but don't worry if the answer doesn't seem obvious. It isn't like ordering room service and expecting exactly what you requested to arrive exactly when you asked it to be. So be patient. Take a shower, which can be a very productive place for unconscious ideas to bubble up. I tell you.
Yeah, I agree.
Shower thoughts are a big thing.
Yeah, I completely agree on that.
I've had many, many ideas. Why didn't I do this?
It's almost at that point where I looked, don't laugh, I looked around for a waterproof whiteboard to put in my shower. Yeah.
I mean,
I have so many weird ideas. Well, I'll rephrase that. Good ideas.
In the shower.
In the shower, yeah.
Whenever I'm in the shower, I just think of things like, for example, the word waterfall is technically the opposite of the word firefly.
Uh-huh.
But that's the kind of thing that comes to me in the shower.
I know. But that's when you're a free flow.
Abstract thinking.
Okay, so fourth, make yourself a tea or coffee or whatever and sit down in a comfortable chair with a pen and a pad of paper. There you go. They didn't say tablet. For half an hour, just write. Don't think too much about what you're writing, or if it makes any sense, just get your thoughts down on paper. And after you've read back what you've written, let the counsel of your conscious mind debate it.
Great ideas. It sounds very similar, though, to meditating, right?
Yeah. And I think it's like now you understand the science behind it and there's a process about it. So any difficult decisions.
Have you done anything like this previously? You know, this idea of like thinking about a problem before you go to bed and hoping you wake up with an answer.
No.
I think we kind of all have in some way.
I've done that and my brain's gone, ask again later.
That wasn't a process. But we've always said, I'll sleep on it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And we know that sometimes, you know, and again, the answer may not come at 7 in the morning, but it'll come a little later once I've sort of like, okay, I can't solve the problem right now. I'll sleep on it.
All right. Time for a short break. Music coming up from The Faces and Gary Clark Jr. When we get back, the CD business. We're going to have a little bit of a chat about that. How it isn't dying, it's just evolving ever so slightly.
Just like vinyl.
Yeah. You're listening to Enterprise Biz Bytes here on BFM 89.9.
Balanced Frank Medium. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bytes. I'm Rich Bradbury in the studio with
Frida Liu
and Christine Wong.
Moving on to our next story. The CD business isn't dying. It's just evolving.
I mean, this is according to an article that was on Fast Company, and it does focus mainly on the way that it's being used in the American indie music world, essentially. So from their peak of $13.2 billion in 2000, U.S. CD revenues have slid to just $1.2 billion in 2016, according to the Recording Industry Association of America. As listeners flock to streaming services like Spotify and Apple Music, the CD's decline isn't slowing down. But it's kind of hard to reconcile that outlook with what's actually happening in the indie music world. So it turns out that a lot of indie music artists often want to still offer something tangible to their fans.
Yeah.
And while that does explain, you know, the resurgence of vinyl albums, CDs are still easier to produce, cheaper to buy, and more profitable to sell than vinyl. According to the article, they also sound objectively better, but I feel like that's a very subjective opinion to have regardless. So the reasons behind the CD's resilience are partly technological. So in the 1990s, commercial quality CDs were all churned out by multi-million dollar facilities using sophisticated plastic injection molding techniques, and they were almost always shipped inside these like little plastic jewel cases with like a whole printing process, and ordering fewer than 1,000 CDs at a time was very impractical.
Yeah.
What's been happening in the US is that smaller shops have found this different process to create CDs called duplication, which involves burning audio directly onto the lacquer of ready-made discs. And instead of using plastic jewel cases, they'll print album art on cardboard, which are less expensive, take less time to make, and also more environmentally friendly.
I had a company that I worked for a few years ago. They essentially provided music, background music to hotels and restaurants and all of that kind of stuff. And they had a CD duplication room.
Right.
So it was like these towers of what looked like a PC.
Yeah.
And you put your what they called the mother CD in the top, which was the original. And then underneath there'd be 10 decks, and you just close the door, push a button, zip, 10 done.
And I'm just thinking with the CDs, is it the older folks? You know what I mean? Because if you're not downloading MP3s and all that, not everybody has a vinyl player.
Right.
But, you know, you get that in your laptop, you'll be able to sort of insert it and everything, so that it's still there.
But how many people nowadays have a CD player at home?
Right.
Yeah, so this is actually kind of the one
thing. You still
have
in your car.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So that sort of thing. So there's probably still a need.
There's still for a market for it, sure. Yeah.
There is definitely a market for it, but that is one of the main issues. I mean, the thing is with CDs is that it's turning more from an actual music source to being a kind of merchandising opportunity, because it is easy to create. But the problem is that CD players are disappearing from everyday consumer products. There have been some surveys that have found that people do still want CD players in their lives. I think just because it is quite familiar to us, and it is an easy way and an accessible way of getting data that's portable and stuff like that. CDs still accounted for 33% of music listening in a car from last September in a survey by Nielsen. So the CD format also still comprises 51% of full album sales in America. And also there are genres where the CDs makes up a plurality of consumption. So like holiday music, gospel music, children's songs, jazz, classical music.
Now that's what I call music compilations.
Yes, right. a lot of those. Actually, the thing is that if there's a real long-term risk to the CD, it's actually the potential undoing of the factors that make CDs easy and cheap to produce. So as CD players decline in kind of production and CD consumption becomes more of like a niche thing, raw CD production materials could become scarcer and more expensive. So the idea is that CD might become the new vinyl, where it becomes kind of rare and a new old cool thing that the hipsters of the next generation will take onto their hands as a mainstream physical music format that offers good audio quality both for listening and copying.
Instead of accidentally throwing it around in the park, they might discover it has something inside.
I was just talking about the technology, right? I mean, if you look at cassettes, I mean, of course, we did the story a couple of weeks ago, but there was a resurgence, and I think it was just from the movie, right? Galaxy of the Guardians of the Galaxy. And then with CDs, I don't know. It's still practical. I can, like you said, maybe, you know, you still, like, I can see an older person giving it as a gift, right? Because cassettes are not so available.
I mean, when I go home and I look, I have a vinyl collection, I have a cassette tape collection, I have a CD collection, I have an 8-track collection.
Oh, you do?
Yeah,
this
you know,
is
the,
dad. Okay.
Exactly. So these are all technologies that I want to hold onto at some point.
Right,
you know,
right.
So there's always going to be, I think there'll always be, like you say, Chris, a niche market for this kind of stuff. So.
And even, for example, Broadway shows, it's a big deal to buy a cast recording on a CD.
Right.
Because that's really, you know, that is the proof, the physical proof. You've been to the show, you have all this music, that's how it gets onto Spotify and Apple Music in the first place.
Right.
You know, so that, like, that's, again, another niche market, but I feel like you can't go to a Broadway show and not get the cast recording.
Did you remember your first CD?
My first CD? No. Oh. I remember my first record.
Oh, right, okay.
It was by The Specials, and it was Ghost Town.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay, so my first cassette. It was Prince.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, it was Purple Rain. And then my first CD was Terence Trent D'Arby.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and it was, you know, and it was so precious because it was made in Germany.
Yes, that was
the technology then, it was, only available in Germany. So there you go.
My first CD was Britney Spears' Blackout album.
Fire her now.
Okay, time to take a break. Music coming up from Ash, A Life Less Ordinary. When we get back, as per usual, on a Monday, some events that we think you might want to check out for this week. Don't go anywhere. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Barry fronts Motown. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Almost time for us to wrap up for today, of course. But before we go, as usual, we've got some events that we'd like you to check out. I just want to quickly address Michael, who's called me a hipster because apparently I have, you know, vinyl and tapes and cassettes and 8-tracks. I'm 40-something years old. Are 40-something years old allowed to be hipsters?
It belonged to the father.
It belonged to my dad, yeah.
Everyone who has what they have is allowed to have what they have. Yes. Is my very
But thank you, Michael. You've made me feel young on a Monday afternoon, so that's good. Right, let's get on with these events. What are we doing first?
Okay, we've got an event which is for next week, right? I think leading up to International Women's Day, which is on March 8th, but this is on Tuesday, March 6th, and it's the Women CEO Biz Exchange Dinner. It's free, but you've got to RSVP on Eventbrite. It's only for women. So this dinner is designed to save you time and money in developing business networks. CEOs and company owners are welcome to exchange connection, information, and contacts on key issues. So who should attend? Female MDs, CEOs, COOs, directors, executive directors, VPs, presidents, and chairperson.
All right.
Looking to network.
I've got something for this Wednesday, actually, February 28th. It's called Let's Jam at Gem 18. It's all about wearing technology, demand versus supply. You can get information over at Eventbrite. It's at Publica Shopping Gallery at Solaris. February 28th, 7:30 p.m. until 9:30 p.m. at Mereka. So smartwatches, smart eyewear, smart footwear, smart clothing, and other smart gadgets are being produced globally to cater for the demanding tech-savvy consumers. Are we in Malaysia a part of that movement, and how can we tap on to the opportunity at hand? Who should attend? Entrepreneurs curious about the potential of wearable technology, or anybody who has an interest in wearable tech.
Yeah, and we also have another event which is called GR Talks, Landing Pages and Conversion Optimization. This is happening on Thursday, March 1st, 2018, from 9:30 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. in the UOA Corporate Tower in Bangsar South. It is 20 ringgit for a ticket. You got RSVP on Eventbrite. Now, this is an hour long. Well, it says hour long. Technically, it's 2 hours long, but I guess there's a warm-up thing and drinks and such. But it's designed to help you understand the basics and best practices of creating a landing page, learning about landing page analytics, and also how to direct traffic to your page and understand the importance of A/B testing. Who should attend are people who are interested in learning more about the technical background of a landing page, how it can help you boost your conversion rates and grow your database, regardless of your business size.
All interesting stuff then.
Yes.
Alrighty, it's come to the end of the show, but quickly what we'll do is, in case you missed any part of this show, don't forget you can download the app from the Apple App Store or from Google Play and have a listen back a little bit later on. Stories that we covered today then, we started off with, in an era of smart things, sometimes dumb stuff is just better.
And speaking of dumb stuff, thanks robots, now these 4 non-tech job skills are in demand.
Right. And then we have 5 steps to harness your brain's unconscious decision-making powers. That's great. And
sleep on it, basically. Yes.
Yep. And we ended with a story about how the CD business isn't dying. It's just evolving.
Right. But don't go anywhere, of course, because coming up after the 1 o'clock news, it is the Breakfast Grill replay. So a world authority on competitiveness, IMD World Competitiveness Centre, is responsible for the publication of the World Competitiveness Yearbook, an annual report which benchmarks the performance of 60 countries based on 333 different criteria. The Breakfast Grill spoke with the founder, Stefan Gorelli, to discuss what defines competitiveness, as well as the challenges businesses and nations will be facing moving forward. That's all coming up after the 1 o'clock news. My name is Rich Bradbury. On behalf of Frida Liu and Christine Wong, this has been Enterprise Biz Bytes. Wrapping us up is some music from the Beatles with All You Need Is Love. We'll be back, of course, tomorrow at noon here on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.